Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Kevin Matthews.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackey.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yep. Yes, you're indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. It's great to be back. It's pouring with rain as we record this. What a winter we're having. Plenty of rain coming, but we need it, and it's good to hear. Now, we've got a special guest on the show, as we always do, and this time it's Gary Luscombe, who regular listeners may remember was the man who is behind creating the statue of famous Australian boxer Johnny Famechan. And that is very near completion. So we're catching up with him. He's just trying to raise the last dollars to get it across the line. And in the meantime, John and I will discuss, well, usual subjects in sport. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, I'm starting us off, I believe, this week.
You are? You are?
Well, it's been talked about for a long time. And as it gets closer, the closing down of the Centre of Excellence, as it got renamed, which is the AIS football programme in Canberra, is getting really near. And the interesting thing for me is the fact that now more and more people are becoming outspoken about it. Josip Skoko, former Socceroo, came out and said, you know, he feels that the FFA really stuffed up because this golden generation was produced through the AIS program, and then when they came into power, they mucked about with a program that was hugely successful, and they changed it all because of obviously the Dutch influence that came in. And one of the key things was when they lowered the age. So what it did was it also affected what the program was all about. And as Steve Darby, who was one of the coaches at the AIS, he also has now come out and said that he feels that this was a major problem when they lowered the age limit, and also when they stuck to a strict curriculum. If you look back, what used to happen was that they would get these talented players in at 17, you know, as they were maturing in their teenage years, and then they would polish the diamonds, and they would actually basically improve the quality. So these guys then, when they left the AIS, they went straight into the old National Soccer League and were ready to play first team football and could hold their own. But what we're seeing now is very few players that have left the AIS, when they've been fortunate enough, and a lot of them haven't been fortunate enough, signed up by A-League clubs. They're still not getting any games. They're stuck in a youth team because they're not ready to play in the first team. Now, exceptions to that have been really the Central Coast Mariners, but that's been purely because they cut their budget and didn't want to spend any money on players, so they went down the youth route, and that's why they've kind of finished bottom of the ladder in recent times. But the plus side is they've given those young players an opportunity. Some of them have gone on to gain contracts overseas. Now, Steve Darby says what he feels now is there's a lack of creativity in Australian football. Have to say, I totally agree with him. He also believes that there's a lack of strength because these boys are so young. And he said what is happening now is there's no strength programs if you look at the Australian sort of production line. Whereas in Asia now, there's so much focus on creating good athletes. We hear that all the time. It's not just about having the skill set. It's also about having good athletes. Now, I think that is, again, a good point and another concern. And he said the problem is everyone's saying the gap in Asia is closing. And it is. And he goes, Australia wanted to play in Asia because they wanted more competition. And he goes, but now they're not liking the fact that the competition is a little bit stiffer than they thought. And there's probably two reasons that, yes, Asia is picking up. They are beginning to get those strength programs. They are beginning to develop athletes. Some of the countries are being very smart and developing a style of play that suits their physique of their players or the skill set that those players have. But the other thing I think a lot of people are denying is that the standard in Australia has dropped. In the last 10 years, the standard in Australia has dropped. And we are now fallen back to those lesser nations. We're not the cream of the crop that we were. And I think that that is a major issue. I just pulled up just to try and justify some of what I'm saying here. And if you look at the recent graduates of the AIS, you know, Trent Sainsbury is probably one of the shining lights in that he's now signed with Inter Milan at 25. Now, you think 25 to 30, you're at the peak of your career. If we look at Nathan Burns, who again came back, he's at FC Tokyo. J-League's not a bad league. It's not a great league. I'm sure at 29 he would have rather been playing in Europe. If you look at James Holland, who again, 28 years old, playing in China. Matthew Sparanovic, 29 years of age, playing in China. Dario Vidicic, playing in Korea, 30 years of age. Nikita Rukovica, playing in Israel, 30 years of age. Robbie Cruz, who was the shining light, if you want my view, of the players that came through the IAS that got to Europe, managed to establish himself and play regular football in a European club. Well, he's 28 at the moment. He'll be 29, I think it's next month. And where's he playing? He's playing in China. And I just think, okay, China, the money is there, but is this helping Australian football playing in a league like that? As I've said on this before, I've commentated the Chinese Super League. I don't think it's that good a league. In fact, I actually would go so far as to say, apart from the top four or five teams, the A-League is a better league than that. And that's saying something, because I don't think the A-League is that great a league. And I think the A-League has gone backwards in terms of its quality from about season six, was when I think it peaked, and then it dropped, and now I think it's plateaued.
What is the purpose of the A-League?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Is it a development league, or is it about having a strong national league? I think if you ask the FFA, they would tell you it's about having a strong national league and attracting good players so that you have a strong competition. Now, they've really pushed to keep a lot of those young players here in Australia rather than letting them go overseas and play for big clubs in Europe. They want to keep the talent within Australia. Is that the right thing? Is the talent good enough? I don't know. I think also, to be fair, the thing that grates with me with the A-League is you have a league where you cannot be relegated. So even if you come last, you are still going to be in the A-League next year. So why do we see teams, when they go on the road, still just play with one guy up front? Why do they play such defensive football? Why not be more attacking? I mean, if you look at the whole thing about Australian football over the years, is we're an aggressive nation. We go on the front foot. We take it to the opposition. So why not have that as the hallmark of this league, where teams actually attack because there is no relegation? You've got nothing to fear. And also, if you come in the top six, you're in the finals anyway. So surely being attacking is a major thing within the league, and it's a great selling point.
Yeah, I think half of the problem, though, is that the coaching orthodoxy isn't that. The coaching orthodoxy at the moment is exactly the mindset that you're talking about of, oh, well, we've got to make sure we don't get relegated. Or even when the coaches are coming into a system where relegation isn't there, they've come through the training and a regime that says this is the way that the game is played. And that's one of the problems I have watching football, is that it is deemed that a draw is a good result. Teams play for a draw.
Look, I think in the big leagues, yes, they do, because going on the road when you've got the opposing fans who are really vocal, and it is a cauldron. I mean, we hear this expression used about, you know, a daunting trip to so-and-so. The atmosphere, and I've been, as you know, on the pitch at many of these venues, and it's not the same as being in a cauldron of in European, where the crowds are bigger and they're baying for blood. But it is still, I will say this, Melbourne is great. The atmosphere in Melbourne is great.
Just on that point, though, what's more daunting for a player? Stuffing up at an away game, or stuffing up at a home game?
I think stuffing up full stop is bad enough.
Well, see, I don't, that thing about home and away, I don't get. I can understand that the pitch conditions and other factors influence a player's performance, you know, the actual physical travel and the change to routine and all that sort of stuff. But as far as the mindset of, you know, the crowd's hostile, well, tell you what, mate, it doesn't take long for your home crowd to turn hostile too. And I don't know that it's as big a deal as perhaps we make it out to be.
I think, John, if you went to somewhere like Galatasaray, you would find it is a major, major thing. It is very, very different in Europe. If you go to games there, the hostility, even as you're approaching the stadium, is phenomenal in some of these places. And I think because you've grown up here in Australia watching it, until you've seen it firsthand, you cannot understand it. And it is a very, very different phenomenon.
Then why do we pay them so much money?
Hey, I can't answer that.
Honestly. Because that's what you're paid for. You're paid not to care about that stuff. And if you start using, oh, well, there's a hostile crowd, well, then give your money
okay,
back.
I remember, I think it was it Scalacci at the World Cup who said, you know, here's a guy, I think it was Scalacci, I might be wrong, but he was saying the Italian player, yeah, he'd taken hundreds of penalties in his career. Came to a World Cup in Italy, had to take a penalty, and he goes, I walked forward to the penalty spot. He goes, I could not feel my legs. For the first time in my life, he goes, I couldn't feel my legs. He goes, just knowing how important that was and all of that. So again, there are factors that come into the game. And yeah, I think you
that
have
goes
to
back to my question. He was playing for Italy in a World Cup final.
Well, it wasn't the final, yeah.
It's a major event in itself, regardless of the crowd that would put the shivers up a player.
Yeah.
And it's in front of his own crowd. It's not in front of a horrible, nasty crowd.
Yeah, but again, I think these are things that we don't know because you and I haven't played elite sport. So
hang on. So standing on that boat in that marina on the Gold Coast with the rock paper scissors, mate, that was an intimidating crowd, especially after the pub had been open about 7 or 8 hours.
Nah, look, it's a difficult one, but I mean, going back to the point, I think the thing that worries me now is, okay, I have no problem if they were going to close down the AIS program. And there's a lot of me thinks that it was the right thing to do. But to then put the onus now on the A-League clubs to be the ones to develop the next generation of players, I think that that is basically shot Australian football in the foot, because I cannot see many of the A-League clubs wanting to invest in that. They're losing money already. So are you going to tell me that they're going to invest in programs to develop youngsters? And how are they then going to pay compensation to the local clubs who they take these youngsters from? I just don't think, A, they're set up for it. I don't think the league is ready for the A-League clubs to do that. And I also think that the A-League clubs are the wrong people to be doing that at this point in time in Australian football's evolution.
Oh, I think you make a very good point. Absolutely. I mean, let's face it, by the time you get to the A-League, and they, as you point out, they're a professional club. It's all about results.
And it's a business. To them, it is a business. It's about getting bums on seats. It's about selling a player for a profit. It's about making money to keep the club sustainable so you can maintain your position in that league and survive.
And how far down the road does that responsibility for junior development go? You know, you're going to have to sign your kiddie up to Perth Glory squad at seven, are you, to go through some sort of junior development program?
Yeah, and this is another thing, you know, that I feel quite strongly about, is if, for example, Perth Glory wants to have junior players wearing the colours of their club, and we have been told this season that the youth sides that play in the National Premier League are separate from the A-League club, but you try telling that to the kids or the parents who play for those
teams,
they don't feel that they're any different.
And but the people they play against wouldn't think any different either.
Absolutely, and the people that come and watch the games aren't going to think any different because they've got the same name. And that was why when the whole NPL thing was going on, I was saying I don't think it's a good idea for them to play under the Perth Glory name. I think call them something else that can be associated to it, like, you know, Glory Grommets or something like that. You know, but it's still connected, but it's not carrying that same name. But the point I was going to make here is, if these children are representing that club and wearing the same colours, should those parents be forced to pay registration fees? Now, the Glory, to be fair, gives a lot of them a discounted registration fee compared to other NPL clubs. But I would think if my son was being asked to play for a club like that, I'd go, yeah, sure, but I'm not paying any fees. If you want him, you're investing in him, and you're going to get the money if he goes and signs overseas, so you finance him to play for you.
That's a good point. Very good point. I would also ask, what does this leave the FFA's job as? If the A-League clubs are going to be doing junior development, are they going to be like the Australian Olympic Commission, just a glorified travel agency every time the Socceroos and the Matildas go overseas? All they do is book planes and hotel rooms. Is that what the role of the FFA is going to become?
Well, you could then pass that down as well, in that you've got Football West, Football New South Wales, Football, you know, ACT, all of those. They've got development programs. They've got coaches within their setup that are going out there supposedly developing these young kids. Where does that leave all of them? Are they now surplus to requirements because you're trying to make the NPL clubs have a technical director, have the qualified coaches? And then, of course, we've got a plethora now of academies that are basically upskilling these young children. And again, parents are paying money for them to go there. So is there a need for the cost attributed to all the state bodies to have that coaching arm?
Funny times ahead. And of course, have you heard any more about FIFA's, conversations with the FFA? I
haven't heard anything at the moment. It's all gone very, very quiet.
It has. We'll wait and see what happens there.
Hi, I'm Tom with the Hitman Hunt. and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And as we said at the top of this podcast, we have a special guest on the show today, and that is Gary Luscombe. Now, Gary is the man who's been driving the Johnny Famersham statue project, and that was a fundraising to build a statue to Johnny Famersham, who was the third legend inducted into the Australian Boxing Hall of Fame. The first was Les Darcy. He has a statue in his hometown of Maitland. Then came Lionel Rose, and he has a statue in Warragul. So it was Gary and a team of other volunteers who decided that they wanted to have a statue for Johnny Famersham in his hometown, and they've been busy putting this together since 2013, but they're so close to the finish line now. We thought we'd catch up with Gary, find out how it's going, because the last time he came on Not the Footy Show, a local Perth business, Norfolk Clinic, actually bought 8 plaques, and they invested, I think it was over $8,000 into the project. So well done the guys from there, and hopefully if anyone else is out there listening, they only need $19,000, I think it is, dollars to get it across the line now. So if you want to donate, I'll give you the website address after the interview with Gary, and I know he mentions it during the interview. Gary Luscombe, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Hello, Ashley. Well, thanks for having me back on Not the Footy Show.
Well, it's been a while since we spoke to you about the Johnny Famersham statue project, and I'm just thinking some of our listeners may have forgotten what it was all about and how the whole project for the statue to one of Australia's great boxers came about. Maybe you can just recap as how the idea came up.
Yeah, well, back in 2010, we unveiled the Lionel Rose statue at his hometown in Warragul, and the first thing that Lionel said was to the sculptor, "I want you to do one for my mate Famo." And the sculptor thought it was a great idea, the people involved in that statue thought it was a great idea, and from that conversation, the statue was commissioned, and Stephen Glassborough, the sculptor, was re-employed to start work. Work started, and from there, We're still plugging away trying to raise the money.
So it's a fair old time then between getting it, the idea, sort of the seed planted, and actually getting the statue erected. I mean, how much money was the budget at the beginning?
At the beginning, and the same budget for the Lionel Rose statue, is a had 15 sponsors donated $12,000 each, and they received a marquette, an exact replica of the Lionel Rose statue, and within 12 months of those people donating that money, they had the Lionel Rose statue unveiled. But unfortunately, with the Johnny Famersham, there were 6 marquettes made, but only 3 of them were sold, where only 3 sponsors came forward, so we had $36,000 to build the statue, which wasn't enough. The actual project was in danger of being scrapped altogether, and I chatted to a few people, and we came up with the idea of fundraising for the rest. And we renegotiated. We got the price down to $156,000, which still sounds a lot of money, but then we took the $36,000 we raised off. We had a grand total of $128,000 to raise. Well, that was 5 years ago. We started our first show in 2013 with their local MP in Frankston, helped the sisters. We got kicked off a fundraising show. We raised about $25,000 that night. And things have happened in between. But we've run 6 fundraising events so far. The last show, we were at $108,000 raised. We can add that to the 36th sponsorship. We're around $144,000. We're about $19,700 short of finishing the project now.
Wow, well, that's still phenomenal effort. I mean, how are you looking to try and get that last, let's call it $20,000, which when you look at the scheme of things that you were getting $156,000, it's not much to get now.
It's not much now, yeah. And we've run 6 fundraisers and that. We want to change it up a little bit. And we're actually even sort of the idea of getting the some sponsors to sponsor the unveiling of the statue and having their company name contribute to that. But this is an idea we just come up with. We're hoping we can do that. And then we've got to plan a date of when we unveil the statue, that sort of stuff. But, you know, if anyone that wants to sponsor us, contact us for sure, because we'll keep fundraising. We'll be doing some raffles and auctions and that sort of stuff. But we'd like to do one big event and an unveiling on the one weekend if we can get that sponsored.
Now, you threw out that sort of call for sponsorship money. I think the last time we spoke, there was a company in Perth that actually came on board and really supported it.
Yeah, Norfolk Clinic. They're at that stage we were selling plaques. They were each one of Johnny Famichon's bouts was on a plaque. He's like, a complete flight record is going to go around the statue. We sold those plaques for $1,000 each. That's part of our fundraising. And a company in Perth, Norfolk Clinic, they actually end up buying 8 plaques. They bought 3 on the day after our last radio show talk, and then every month after that, for about 5 months, they bought another plaque. They ended up donating $8,000 towards the project.
Well, fantastic. Now, just thinking there, when you're talking about those plaques, and there's one for every fight that Johnny Famichon had, what was the date that he won the world title? Because I'm just thinking, would that be a good date to maybe have the unveiling of the statue?
I think that'd be a great idea. January the 29th, 1969, he actually defeated Jose Ligera that day. That's an important day in Australian history. I think you come up with a great idea there, Ashley. I've got to look into that. January the 29th, 2018, I think I'm going to book that in for the unveiling of the Johnny Famichon statue.
Well, it's funny that we've come up with that there, but I mean, I'm just thinking, January, you should be able to raise the 20,000 in the 6 months between then, and if you do hold a function, you know, a dinner before the unveiling or on the day of the unveiling, hopefully there'll be enough people that'll pay the money to be a part of something so special.
Yeah, and, to unveil the statue on the anniversary of his title win, I think it is, and with, we hope to get a few international and interstate guests down that day to so it'll be a good weekend to be involved with. So any sponsors want to be involved that weekend, contact us now.
Now, if people want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to contact you, Gary? Because I know you're busy with your job. This isn't what you do full-time, but you're giving a lot of your time towards the project.
Yeah, people say they give it a lot of time, but it's been a very enjoyable, 5 years, because I've met a lot of great people on the way, been on Not the Footy Show, and got to meet your mate, the great Zuma Nelson, who's one of my idols when I was growing up. So I've had quite a great time during the 5 years. It's been a lot of hard work, I've been a lot of up and downs, but Jesus, there's some good days too. And the unveiling is going to be astronomical too, I just can't wait. And but the best way to get to contact me is everything we do, we put on our website, www.johnnyfamichonstatue.com. And my phone number is on there, my email address is on there. Anybody can contact us, and anything we're up to can be done through that website.
Fantastic. Now, just to sort of put this into context, I believe that Lionel Rose was only the second statue to a boxer in Australia. Les Darcy was the only other man with one. So
yes,
this is a very special occasion.
That is, and it's funny, that's coincidental, but Les Darcy was the first legend inducted into the Australian National Boxing Hall of Fame, and he had a statue. Lionel Rose was the second legend inducted into the Australian National Boxing Hall of Fame, and he had a statue. The third legend is Johnny Famichon, and we're very close to completing his statue. There's only been four legends. That was coincidental. It wasn't planned that way, but it'd probably be a good plan to go ahead with their legends. But they're the only three statues in Australia of boxers that I know of.
Now, you mentioned the sculpture, and you very kindly shared an email with me from Stephen Glassborough, and I was reading that he believes this is the best statue he's done, so again, it's going to be really special. Have you actually seen it yet?
I've only seen the plaster cast, the plaster, which is, he's built it in plaster, and it's gone to mould now, but, we went up there 2 years ago when he was nearly finished the plaster mould with Johnny Famichon, his wife Glenys, Jeff Fenwick and Brock Jarvis, the boxer that Jeff Fenwick's training now. We went up there to visit Stephen Glassborough, and we looked at this, and when it was covered in a wet hessian bag, it was just a plaster mould. When they pulled it off, we just could not believe the resemblance and how good it actually looked to the two Johnny families on. We were just in awe. And John's son, Paul, was there. He had tears in his eyes when he saw it.
Fantastic. So the unveiling, when it happens, is going to be a very emotional time. How big is the statue? I mean, I've seen the one of Rocky Marciano sort of up in Boston way, but is it a huge statue?
It's 2.1 metres high.
That's pretty big.
It's 1.5 life size. And the reason they do that, apparently, you're speaking to Stephen Glassbauer, is when they put it up on the stand, the actual effect that it actually looks life-size when it's up in the air, when it stands about a metre and a half up in the air, and that it gives the actual effect of life-size. So they deliberately build the statues 1.5 times its life-size.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting, isn't it? I never knew that.
Yeah, I never even thought about that, but actually, when you look up at it, when they look, because it's up in the air, it actually, they get the effect that it's actually life-size.
Fantastic. So you mentioned as well you're doing a few more fundraising events. I mean, what's coming up? Are you holding any more dinners? Or I know you've got a lot of memorabilia for sale on the website, and people can obviously go there and purchase that, and they'll be helping the cause as well.
Yeah, we do memorabilia sales. We actually do memorabilia raffles before the functions. We've only just finished one function where we're going to start planning our next function now. But another thing, my wife came up with it. She actually got casts of from the market of Johnny Famichon. She's actually made key rings and lapel pins. So there's actual badge and key rings that are exact replica of the Johnny Famichon statue. They're on sale now as well.
And they're presumably through the website as well.
Yeah, through the website, yeah. And you can buy a set of those with postage for about $28. And you've got an exact replica of the statue, and you've got a lapel pin. You can wear a badge as well.
Is there a limited number of those? Because I'm thinking that would be a really good collectible item.
There's only 250 made, and I don't think we'll be making any more made, so that will be limited to 250.
So if people want a piece of boxing memorabilia and they can't go to sending thousands of dollars, they can make a contribution of a smaller level and have a piece of boxing history as well.
Yeah, and on the unveiling date, they can wear their badges. They can't get there, they can wear a badge. They can be a part of the Johnny Famichon unveiling.
Look, that's fantastic. Now, Gary, before we let you go, just a reminder again of the website. And if people want to follow, you do also have a Facebook page as well, don't you?
Yeah, Johnny Famichon Statue Project is our Facebook page. There's a lot of information on there as well. And the website, which everything goes on there, is www.johnnyfamichonstatue.com.
Fantastic. Yeah. Look, Gary, yeah, what were you going to say? Sorry.
Oh, if you just Google Johnny Famichon, the actual link to the website will come up.
Look, That's great. Look, I mean, it's fantastic what you've done, you and your wife, and I know everyone else that's involved with it. I can't wait to see the statue, and really hope you get to raise this final 20,000 and can have that really memorable day, maybe on the anniversary of Johnny winning the world title.
Well, yeah, you just ran out of an idea there, Ashley, and I'm very tempted. I actually got to push for that date now. I don't know why, but the what a better way to celebrate the anniversary of his title win than the Valley statue. I just can't wait.
Well, it's been great catching up with you again, Gary, and we wish you all the best, and I'll stay in touch with you.
No worries. Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for having us on the Not the Footy Show. It's great to be on that. Thank you.
This is Sugar Ray Leonard, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, now there's a legend if ever there was one, Sugar Ray Leonard. Well, if you want to get involved with the Johnny Famichon statue and help Gary get it across the line, the website is johnnyfamichonstatue.com. There's memorabilia you can buy, and even if you only spend $20, $30 buying a piece of that memorabilia, you're going to still be helping get that statue across the line. As we said, they just need just over $19,000, and then they will be unveiling the statue in Frankston, Johnny's hometown. And Gary did contact me after we did this interview because he got the date of Johnny winning the world title wrong. It's actually going to be January the 21st will be the anniversary of him winning the world title, and that's when they're going to unveil the statue, not January the 29th. So if you want to be in Frankston at that date, make sure you are. There's going to be a dinner, as he touched on there, probably to celebrate the unveiling, and again that should be a brilliant event because I know Jeff Fenwick is going to be there and a few other Australian champions, and we're trying to get Azuma Nelson to make his way over to Australia as well. So a really big date for your calendar if you want to go across to the Eastern Seaboard.
Excellent. Now it's my turn. Where do I start? Been doing some thinking over the weekend, Ashley. Do you remember back in the day, back when we were a little bit younger than we are now, there used to be a regular radio program called This Sporting Life. It was hosted by Rampaging Roy Slaven and H.G. Nelson, and it was, for many of us, it was a bit of a tradition on a Saturday afternoon to have a listen to the ramblings of Roy and H.G. But the tagline to their show, This Sporting Life, too much sport is barely enough. And for a long time I believed that. But over the weekend, I'm starting to get a little bit jaded. And I'm just starting to think, is there too much meaningless sport that just doesn't have any connection to anything? Recently, we've seen some English football teams down in Australia playing games and some other teams from other countries. And, yeah, it's nice to see them, but what did those games mean? Nothing. We see 2020 cricket happening all across the globe all the time. What do those games mean? Nothing. We've got my own sport, hockey, announcing a pro league, which is just another international competition. We've already got plenty of international competition. Why do we need the pro league? Another international competition. And I'm just starting to get worn down by this endless, meaningless sport that's thrust into my face on the television screen. I love sport. You know that I love sport, but, you know, another friendly? Really?
I know where you're coming from. I think there's a quantity over quality is how I would describe it. And the thing is, I'm now a lot more discerning. Like, I really couldn't give a monkey's about Arsenal, Chelsea, Man United, partly because I don't support those teams. So if they're coming down to Australia and they're playing Sydney FC or anything, I don't care. It's a friendly game. Does not bother me. Back in England, I would go to the friendly games with Swindon Town because they were my team, and I wanted to see how the new signings were performing, what they looked like, were they any good, were they useless, or were they struggling to fit in. So you went to those games because you had a connection with the club. If it's any other club, I don't care. I really don't. And I must admit, I agree with you in that I'm finding it hard now because you're trying to watch all of the games, and I've got a bit of a backlog now on the recordings.
Yeah.
And it's trying to find the time even then to watch the recordings, because life is different to the way it used to be. There are other things that call on your demands of, or make demands on your time.
And there's so much now more that's sport, or is inverted commas sport, on television. Things that are mere pastimes, if that, are suddenly elevated into do or die battles. And it just is so irritating. And if I hear another person describe themselves as having to battle and using war metaphors, I will break the TV. I'm sick of it. It's nothing like war. Sport is nothing like war. Let's stop using those stupid metaphors.
Do you know, it's really interesting that you make that point, because I thought exactly the same thing at the weekend. I could not believe how frequently we had those metaphors used. And I was thinking, hey, this is getting out of hand. This is really inappropriate for those poor soldiers and the guys that do go out and fight for our nation and to defend our freedom. This is not right, because it is trying to put sport on the same level. And as you say, quite rightly, it is not. I have no wish to go to war, and I just have no idea what those guys go through.
No, absolutely. And the other thing that's really starting to irritate me at the moment is, how many greatest moments in the sport's history can you have in one season? Every game seems to throw up some moment that is the greatest the sport has seen, or will go down in the annals, and these commentators just overdriving everything that happens on a field. Yeah, that was a fair tackle, but it's not curing cancer. You know, put it all in perspective, please.
But also the words great, legend, you know, again, there's the amount of people that are being called legends who really are not legends. Like, Don Bradman is a legend, you know? In the sporting context and in the cricketing world, he is up there because he is one of the greats of the game. But there are a lot of other people that are not. I mean, it's funny, like Tim Cahill has done really well. I get very upset when people go, he's the greatest Australian player ever. Now, he may have scored the most goals, but does that make him the greatest socceroo ever? I don't think so. In my opinion, there have been players who are far more talented than he was and, you know, played and had more success. How do you measure it? You know, is it on trophies won? You know, to me, Mark Viduka was a far, far better player than Tim Cahill. Okay, he may not have achieved things at international level, but we have to remember that he was used differently to the way he was in a club scenario. Also, when he played international level, all the other teams knew he was dangerous. And I'll never forget the game in Nuremberg in the, the Confederations Cup, and Argentina put two players on him, and he still managed to create a penalty and set up another goal for John Aloisi with two Argentina players on his back. And that showed, that was the day I remember going, man, Mark Viduka is unbelievable.
Yeah, I just wish we could cut down on the meaningless stuff. You know, there's too much T20 cricket played. If Australia played three T20 cricket games a year, I'd probably be interested in watching them. But they don't. They play 30 or 40 and it's just boring.
Yeah, I haven't watched one yet, so...
And please, hockey, look twice at the Hockey Pro League. I mean, it's just another one of... It'll end up just being another meaningless international tournament that no one, you know, really cares that much about, except for the players who are involved.
Well, are we guilty for this trend, though, John? Because let's not forget, we launched this show. No, not the footy show. We launched it 2005. We featured over 75 sports on this show. Some you could say were pastimes, like darts, kabaddi. I mean, are they really... kabaddi's been described as light entertainment sport.
By who?
A TV producer that's worked for Star.
How does the Indian society see kabaddi, though? Do they see it as a sport?
They see it as a sport.
Well, it's a sport.
You know?
It's no good for some bloke from outside of even the culture trying to pinpoint
This is the thing, and you've, again, hit the nail right on the head, because what we may deem is like, it is not really a sport. To other cultures, it is a sport. It is a major, major event.
Mate, cooking is not a sport.
No, that's true.
Okay? Spelling correctly is not a sport.
No.
Doing something weird that's mildly entertaining is not a sport.
Bog snorkeling? Because, we did feature that.
I reckon bog snorkeling is more of a sport than Ninja Warrior.
I would say bog snorkeling is a sport because you do need to do it probably. It's hardly a pastime.
Yeah. But, I mean, and a lot of these things that are now being elevated to some sort of sporting level and using the metaphors of sport in entertainment shows. Oh, quick, where's a nectar ring?
Before we wrap up, John, because you've had your little rant there, we should just mention, obviously, the passing of Les Murray.
Yes.
Now, I just want to remind people of a story. I was in Uruguay with Les Murray and Johnny Warren in 2001 when the Socceroos were trying to qualify for the 2002 World Cup, and we would eat really late in Montevideo each night because that's the way they do things over there. And there would always be these street kids hanging around, and you had to be really wary because they were looking to pick your pockets. Anyway, we were walking back to the hotel, and this kid suddenly, his hand darts into Les Murray's pocket, and he grabs Les's credit cards. And you've never seen Les Murray and Johnny Warren go off in hot pursuit of this young boy. It's an image that will live with me as long as I live. Anyway, and they went running down the street, and then this boy really cleverly, as he's running, has sifted through the cards, and he's chucked a whole lot of them just on the pavement. And both Johnny and Les Murray stopped, picked those up, thinking he's just dropped the lot. But he took his main SBS gold card, and he kept going with that one. And this was, let's not forget, this was 2001, and things weren't quite so easy to cancel then as they are now. And I remember Les Murray was up all night trying to get hold of the bank to cancel this card. God. But, look, I think he did a heck of a lot for football. I think it's just sad towards the end that he became embroiled in the whole scandal with the World Cup bidding and Qatar. And it's a shame that that's, in my opinion, tarnished his reputation towards the end of his career on air.
It seems many people have been surprised, but is this something that has been, you know, has Les been sick or?
I think he must have been, but it was kept fairly quiet.
Yeah. I mean, he was the Doyen of Australian soccer for so long, it's not funny.
Well, he was a double act. There was no doubt him and Johnny Warren were the Crusaders. And SBS, you know, without them, football in this country would have gone nowhere.
And that was in some fairly dark times for the game as well, that they were carrying that banner.
Absolutely. And just finally, congratulations to Sorrento, who are the first WA team to progress through the round of 32 in the FFA Cup. So well done to them.
See ya. We'll be back next week.